Okay, so, like I said, problem with the Old Testament, it's old, and there's a lot that's going on here, and because of the time limits that we have even on a given Sunday, or the time limits that we have in a year to even get in a sermon series like this, you necessarily have to jump a little bit. And that's what we've been doing. Last week, if you remember, we jumped all the way to the end almost of the story, almost, where David is the king, and he's going after the ark. And we looked at, what does the ark mean? What is the ark saying to us? What's the ark mean for us? And what we found with David is that for him, it was his peace, the presence of God that he could enter into. And he knew somehow that if he had that and he brought it to the city, that he could be king. He needed it just for guidance, just to live. Day by day, he needed that presence, not just to know about it in the distance, but to feel it, to experience it for himself. And so that was when David was an older man, after he'd made a few mistakes, which we'll get into in the coming weeks. But now what we're doing is jumping back. And this is back in time where David's not the king. He's not the king yet. But I chose this passage because it's continuing with the chronology of David's life. And it's important to know how God is working, not just in David's life, but in the lives of others. Because, and I've said this many weeks now, in David's life, or from it rather, we get this wonderful collection, this heartfelt book of songs and psalms, where he talks about his pain and his hurt and his isolation and his loneliness. And there's times that he questions God. God, what are you doing? Where are you? Why do you forsake me? Why do you leave me? And the beauty of the Psalms is that they're of a person's real life. They're not just poems. They're not just, you know, ethereal dreams. They are actual things that happened to David, for the most part, that he records, his hurt, his emotions, his pain, because it's a process that he's going through. His life, his relationship with God is a process, and he's working it out. Now, though, David's not king yet. Saul is king. And there's something that you have to see today about Saul that's really, really profound. And I know the Old Testament, it's difficult to apply it to our lives. I understand that. Modern people, what is going on here? Saul and Samuel going back and forth. I'll break it down, and I'll try to make it rather interesting for you. But you should know this. This passage is one of the most famous texts in all the Bible, and it's called, famously, the rejection of Saul. Saul gets rejected. Why? God comes and says through Samuel, the prophet, and he says, Saul is not going to be my king anymore. And you have to know why. To answer the question, why is there evil in the world? Why do people, human beings, do bad stuff? And what's God's reaction to it? Saul is a very interesting case study, sociologically speaking. He's a very interesting case study for the way in which God works out evil and suffering. You can ask, why do people do mean things? And the answer, part of it, at least a little bit, is found in this passage about Saul. Let me give you context, though, okay? I said we're jumping back in time, going back and forth, and I promise, or try to promise, Cub Scout honor, that I'll keep linear, chronologically speaking, from now on. I'll try not to jump you around. But here's what's happening. You remember a little while back in Israel's history, they were ruled by the judges, these people who are sort of religious, socio-political leaders. God had put them to rule the people, to govern them, to give them guidance. But it wasn't good enough for them. They weren't happy with that. So then what he does after the judges, the period of the judges, God raises up these, or he did it even before, but he's raising up these priests, these high priests. And yet they're religious leaders, yes, but they're also the guiding point and the guidepost for the people of Israel. They're who they went to when they wanted answers, when they wanted to make sense of life. If you were here a few weeks ago, we talked about Eli, the high priest. Now, he got booted from the job. He got kicked to the curb. And little Sammy, who's now venerated Samuel, comes up. And Samuel now, he's the high priest. And he's a little bit older, a lot older, actually, we think, at this point. And he's been the high priest for a while, and everybody in Israel is looking to him. But he's getting old. He's getting old. And the people know, and they come to him and they say, listen, you're getting very old, and you're not going to be with us for long. And they see Samuel has two sons who would have succeeded him. Oh, but these sons are screw-ups. What is it with the boys in this chapter, in this book, being screw-ups all the time? Remember Eli's two sons, they were screw-ups. And it says here that Samuel's own two sons were screw-ups. They were taking bribes. They were corrupt. And the people come and they say, Samuel, you're going to die soon. And your sons aren't going to be able to do the job that you're doing. We need a king. And Samuel says, no, you don't want a king. No. You have God. He's your king. He's your guide. All you need is him. And the people say, no. And there's one point where they actually say, we want to be like others. If you look at 1 Samuel chapter 8, it says this, when Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn son was Joel, and the name of his second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. Yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes, perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, behold, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, obey the voice of the people and all that they say to you. For they haven't rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. The people got what they wanted, and the Lord lamented it, it says. So here he says, God says, okay, y'all want a king. They say, we want to be a king like everybody else. We want to have a king like all the other monarchies, all the other people around us. And God says, but you're not like all the other people around you. And they say, but we want to be. And he says, fine. You got what you asked for. And they get Saul. And Saul starts off as a very humble guy. I'll explain that in a little while because it's very important to the story and what Samuel says to him in the end. Saul starts off as a very, very humble guy. Actually, it's funny. It's a kind of a comical story when they're trying to anoint him and they're saying, you're going to be the king. You're the anointing. And they look around and they say, where's Saul? And he was over hiding in the luggage. And they have to go get him and pull him out. He comes from the tribe of Benjamin. And that doesn't sound important to you right now, but I'll explain why that's important later. See, Saul starts off as a humble king, and he gets victory after victory after victory. He gets older and older, and he becomes a well-venerated king. He becomes a powerful king. And yet, in this story, the Lord rejects him, it says. The Lord says, that job that I gave you, get out. You, Saul, have failed. And you have to ask, when you read this passage, a few questions. And here's the questions that I'll ask tonight. And if you want to follow along and take notes, here's the questions. How did Saul fail? Why did Saul fail? And what did God do about it? What's his answer to it? And let me say, if you don't think you can relate to Saul this evening, you're missing a great narrative. Sociologically speaking, Saul's life is one of the great answers to the question, why do people fail? Why do people screw up in life? Why do people do mean, dumb, bad things and then try to lie about it and cover it up? Why do we do that? Why do we fear people finding out who we really are? Saul does, and he covers, and he lies, and he ducks, and he runs. And God says, I'll have none of it. First, how did Saul fail? Before you get to the why, how, let me explain this. It's referenced in verse 13, and I got to address it in a couple minutes here because it's extremely valid. Saul failed. He was given a command. God says, go to the Amalekites. And if you want to know about the little Amalekites, go to the book of Amos and other parts of the Bible. You'll see that they were a brutal, genocidal tribe, nation. And God says, go to them and wipe them out. Hold on. This is why people have a problem with the Old Testament God. And I know it. And I'm here to tell you, the Old Testament God is the same as the New Testament God, but it doesn't look that way, especially when he does things like this. He says, Saul, go wipe them out. Don't let one thing live. Not their cattle, not their ox, not their animals, not their women. Get rid of them all. And Saul doesn't do it. At least not the way God said. See, and you're right to have a problem with this if this rubs you the wrong way. Why would an all-loving God, why would the God of that I worship say, go kill all those people and wipe them out? Let me explain something that's going on here. And if you're a fan of politics, if you're a fan of war strategies, this will get you. If you go back to that command that God says, essentially he says, go to the Amalekites, this murderous, brutal band of people, and wipe them out. Now, if you know anything about wars, everybody says they go to war for a good purpose, right? Most people say we're going to war for truth or for justice. Look what God says to them. He says, you are not allowed to profit one bit from this war. He says, you can't take home the spoils. You can't take home the slaves and put them into labor. You get nothing, he says, out of this war. Let me put it another way. Typically, when nations go to war with one another, it's for gain. It's for glory. It's for more labor. It's for more land, more money, is it not? I know we'd like to say, and we like to believe our leaders say, we go to war for truth and justice, and sometimes yes, but a lot of times it's just masking the ulterior motives to going into battle. And God says, you will go to war, but you will go to war unlike any other nation that ever has gone to war. You don't profit from it, God says. You don't gain anything from it. You don't gain labor. You don't gain land. You don't gain animals. You don't gain money. He says, you can't take anything home with you. I just want to point out this fact. If you have a problem with the God of the Bible saying, wipe them all out, you must know that what he's saying here is unlike any war that would have taken place. And the proof is this. Saul fails. He does take home the best sheep. He does take home the best ox. He does take home the king. What Saul is doing, he's going to war like everybody else. He's going to battle saying, what's in it for me? He's going to battle and says, I will profit from this. He's forgotten what God says. God says, listen, I can't stand evil. And if you're a pacifist, this might bother you. But sometimes you know that the only way to get over a force is to exert force onto it. And God says, a force must be exerted onto them. But listen, it will be unlike any war ever taken place because the prevailing army doesn't win anything. They don't gain. But Saul says, no. I want to profit from this. So he takes the animals, and he takes the king. He defies the word of God. And if you have a problem with that, I understand. If you have a problem with the God who says, go wipe them out, good. We can talk about that over pizza later. But what you must know that God is saying to them, you're doing something radically different. Yes, you're going to battle, but not like any other nation around you. And Saul says, nah, I'm king. I want something out of this. I want a prophet. And God says, no. What he's doing here, Saul, he's obeying God only as it is convenient for him to do so. You see his failure. His failure, it's not that he lost the war. His failure is that he went to the war and he says, what do I gain out of this? What's in it for me? He listens to God, but he doesn't hear him. Essentially, what Saul is saying is, I will live my life as king as it benefits me. I will obey you, God, when it's convenient for me. But when it's convenient for me to get all those sheep and take them back home, or get all that money and take it back home, or get this king and hold him for ransom, I'll do that. The failure of Saul, as he says, I'm number one. Yeah, God, okay. He hears God. And he goes off and he does the exact opposite of what he was supposed to do. He fails. Now, that's how Saul failed. Why did he fail? He gives you the answer. Why did he refuse to listen to the word of God? Why did he say, I'm numero uno? What makes me happiest, I'll do. I'll listen to God to a point, and then whatever makes me happy, that's what I'm actually going to focus on. That's my primary driver in life. Why? Why does he do it? It's not just a reflection on foreign policy. This story is about a man and his failures. And it's interesting in the dialogue that he has with Samuel. Samuel comes to him and says, you failed. You didn't do what God said to do. What is Saul's reaction? Look back at your Bible. He says, no, I did. And Saul has this idiom. He says, what's this noise in my ear then? Why are these things bleeding and crying out in my ear? Saul says, I don't know. Not my problem. It's your problem, basically. Saul covers. He ducks. He runs. Remember, Saul started off as a humble king. God picked him. Now, he's an egotistical king who says, I will serve God when and if and how it benefits me. And Samuel comes to confront him with the truth, and what does Saul do? He covers. He lies. He deflects. He self-deceives. Why? Samuel says, you listened to him, but you didn't take heed of him. And Saul says, yes, I did. Somebody's telling a lie. Somebody's not telling the truth. Who? Saul. But the perverse thing about this passage is that Saul even has convinced himself that he's telling the truth. You see this dialogue. He goes back and Samuel presses him. And Saul says, no, I did it. And Samuel says, no, you didn't. He goes, yeah, I did. And he says, no, you didn't. He says, oh, well, okay, I got you. I didn't really do it, but it's their fault. And he blame shifts. What Saul is doing is what's still going on today. When we deceive ourselves, when we say, no, I didn't really do that, when we cover, when we run, when we say, no, that's not me, and we put all the shameful things and the bad things that we've done, and we try to squash them or hide them from people's view. That's what Saul's doing. Do you see this? He's afraid. He's afraid he's going to be found out to be the phony that he is. Samuel says, you didn't listen to God. And Saul says, yes, I did. And Samuel says, no, you didn't. And Saul goes, okay, fine. I didn't really listen to him. But it's their fault, not mine. And then he pushes him a little further. And at the end, Saul says, but I was afraid. I feared the people, Saul says. See, Saul is tricking himself. He's deceiving himself. He's lying to himself. He's not even able to look at his own heart and know the condition of it. And he's gonna trump his chest up, and he's gonna parade and puff his chest out to say, I did everything that God said. And Samuel says, no, you didn't. Then he says, well, no, I'm gonna blame shift, and it's their fault, it's their fault, it's their fault. Look, people, this is not what we still do. When we do the wrong things, when we mess up, when we screw up, and somebody comes to us and confronts us on it, what do we say? Most often than not, let's be honest, no, I didn't really do that. Or it's not as bad as you think. It's complicated. I love that. It's complicated. It's more complicated than you know. Saul does it, and he blame shifts. We still do it. Let me give it a, okay, if you don't like Saul's example, let me give you another silly example. My wife and I drive in the car, and if you are a husband or a wife, you know this to be true. We're driving in the car. This happened more than once. We have our friendly navigation system. I boop, 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 put the numbers in the navigation system, and that's supposed to take us where we go. So I'm driving and driving. Driving, right turn, left turn, right turn. We're lost. And my wife says, honey, are we lost? What's my first reaction? Come on, guys. You know it. No, we're not lost. Are you kidding me? Honey, I think we're lost. No, this navigation system just is stupid. It doesn't work. I've actually used this one time. I said, I think the restaurant moved. What is that? It's self-deception. Why? Because I don't want to be proven to be the idiot who doesn't know where he's going in the car, who can't even follow a simple map. So what do? I blame navigation system. I blame the restaurant moved. Or maybe I just turn the music up and say, we're not lost. You see, I know, that's stupid. It's a silly example, but you see at the root of it, that's what Saul's doing. He says, I'm not lost. I'm okay. I did everything right. And Samuel says, no, you didn't. And Saul says, well, maybe I didn't, but it's not my fault. It's their fault. Samuel says, no, it's not. And then Saul says, well, I only did it because I was afraid of them. And Saul taps into what is one of the most predictable signs of human behavior, fear. He says it. He says, I did all this because I feared them. I feared that if I didn't listen to them, Why? I don't know. He doesn't elaborate, but you can take a guess. He probably feared that he'd be looked at as a failure as a king. He probably looked like he'd look like an idiot for not taking the spoils of war like every other king does. People would have said, Saul, what's wrong with you? Are you weak? You're getting soft in your old age. He says, I feared them. I feared the people. I feared them. Look what he's driven by. Why does Saul fail? Because he's driven by fear. But he's driven by the fear of the people around him. The fear of being the king. The fear of being found out that he's a phony, that he's weak, that he's soft. He says, I did it because I was afraid of them. He's deceiving himself. He's telling himself, it's okay. I did everything right. And Samuel's needling him. No, you didn't. And he says, I know I didn't do it, but it was because I was afraid of them. He's self-deceiving. This is why Paul in Romans 7, you know this famous passage probably, I do not understand what I do, he says. For what I want to do, I do not do. What I hate, I do. And if I do what I do not want to do, I agree that the law is good. As it is no longer I myself who do it, but it is sin living in me. For I do not do the good I want to do, but the evil I do not want to do, this I keep on doing. But you see what Paul's talking about now? Fear. Being driven. He says, I know what I'm supposed to do. Saul knew it. He was the king. God came to him directly and said, this is what you're supposed to do. And Saul didn't do it. Why? He was afraid of them. Now let me explain something really quickly before I move on. You got to get to the heart of why you and I do the same thing Saul does, why we trick ourselves, why we lie to ourselves, and we try to say, no, it's not as bad as you think it is, or it's complicated. Or if I get lost on the street, honey, we're not lost. The restaurant must have moved. It's not my fault. We live a life continually like Saul saying, it's not my fault. It's not as bad as you think. We're lying to ourselves because we're afraid. And in the Bible, the fear is not necessarily a bad thing. Let me explain. In the Bible, it says many times to fear God. What does that mean? It's not the fear like you and I think. It's not the fear of a horror movie where we say, don't open the door. You don't know what's behind there. It's not that fear. It's not Nightmare on Elm Street type fear. The fear of the Bible says this, you must be in awe of him. You must be in reverence of God, or you'll be in reverence of others. You see this? Saul should have been afraid of God. Saul should have been in awe of God. Saul should have been shaken by God in his opinion of him. But he's guided by the opinions of others. He screws up because all he cares about is what other people are going to say about him. The fear of people. There's a writer, Edward Welch, a Christian counselor, for 30-some years, wrote a great book, and here's the title of the book, and it's really what happened in Saul's life, and I'll explain in a second. The title of the book is When People Are Small, or People Are Big and God Is Small. When People Are Big and God Is Small. And Edward Welch, what he does is he proposes a hypothesis. Remember, decades and decades of Christian counseling. And he says, this is one thing I found to be true. The majority of the issues that I uncover in counseling sessions are by people who are living lives of fear of other people. They're afraid they're going to be found out. They're afraid that their reputation is going to sink. They're afraid they're not going to get love from the other person, their spouse or whatever. He says, all my clients, the one prevailing, predominant theme is that they are all afraid. And when they do that, he says, and when we do that, he says, we make people big and we make God small. Their opinions matter. See, this is what Saul is saying. He says, I only did this. I screwed up. I didn't listen to God. Why? Because I feared what they would say about me. I feared what they think about me. And if we're honest today, that same fear grips all of our hearts. Edward Welch writes in his book a couple questions. And he basically says this, do you not think that you are not guided by fear of other people? He says, here's your test. And he asks a few questions. I won't read them all. But he says, have you ever struggled with peer pressure? Peer pressure, he says, is simply a euphemism for the fear of man. Are you overcommitted? Do you find that it's hard to say no to people, even when wisdom indicates that you should? Then you're a people pleaser, another euphemism for the fear of man. Are you overly needy on your spouse? Do you need your spouse to listen to you and respect you? If you do, you're living in fear. Your spouse will quietly take the place of God in your life. He goes on, he says, well, if that doesn't work for you, it's self-esteem. Self-esteem, is that critical for you? He says, if self-esteem is critical for you, then you're living in fear of other people's opinions of you. He says, do you ever feel as if you might be exposed as an imposter? Then you're living in fear. He says, are you always second-guessing decisions because of what other people might think? Then you're living in fear. He says, do you feel empty or meaningless? Then you're living in fear and you're letting others control you. Do you get easily embarrassed, he says? Then you're letting other people have an inordinate control over your life. He goes on and on. He says, are you jealous? Then you're afraid of what other people have that you'll never get it. And he goes on and on. And what his main point is this. He says, listen, people, we're all like Saul. We live our lives guided not by the fear of God and awe of him, but rather the awe and the reverence and the respect from others in our lives. Whatever it may be, we fear losing. We fear being found out. We fear not getting what they have. We fear being found as a phony, Edward Welch writes. We fear being exposed. Why do you think Saul goes through such lengths to say, no, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I didn't do it. This is the priest. He's lying to the priest. The priest would surely know if he did it. What's Saul doing? He's not just lying to Samuel. He's lying to his own heart. He knows that his life is one gripped by fear, and he doesn't want to be exposed. So he's willing to make everyone else happy at the expense of his own conscience. Let me put it this way. John Paul Sartre has an interesting work on this called Being in Nothingness, and he puts it this way. Here's the illustration. He says, all of us live functionally, he says. All of us live functionally, as if, or we're most comfortable as if we're looking through a keyhole. He says, as if we're looking through a keyhole at somebody else, and we can see everything they're doing, but they can't see us. And he argues that this is where we find our value, this is where we find meaning, this is where we find confidence. We say, I can see through the keyhole. I see them, they don't see me. There's a really interesting part where he says, but the worst fear comes. And he gives the illustration. He says, there's a man looking down in the keyhole, and he sees another man. And he's thinking about this person, and he's talking about him, and then all of a sudden, the man looking through the keyhole hears twigs break in the back. He hears branches snap. He hears a noise, Sartre says, and he turns to see that all the while, he was being eyed through the keyhole himself. And he's shaken by fear, and he feels embarrassed, and he feels worthless, and he feels naked almost. You see, the keyhole. Wouldn't it be great if we could look at everybody else in a keyhole, but they couldn't see us? Sartre says, but when people see the keyhole and they see you, that's what's going to scare you because they see all of you. You're exposed. He says, I grasp the other's look at the very center of my act as the solidification and alienation of my own possibilities. I know it's a little wordy. It's philosophy. In fear or in ancient or prudent anticipation, I perceive that these possibilities which I am and which are the condition of my transcendence are given also to another. He says, the other person looking through the keyhole, now I know that my transcendence is transcended. Let's put it that modern English. What's he saying? He says, when you realize that people can look in the keyhole and they can see into your life, it'll shake you to the core. You'll start to know your transcendence has been transcended. You're not who you thought you were. You are exposed. You are seen for who you are. And let me tell you, I can see some of the looks in your eyes. Does that not scare you to death? To have somebody who looks through the keyhole into your life and sees every deep, dirty, dark, nasty thing you've ever said or done. Oh, that should make you shiver. And Sartre goes on to say, listen, all of us live this way. And we'll always be in fear of what other people see about us through the keyhole. And through the Bible, we know we will always live in that fear. Saul lived it, and that's why he was rejected now. Do you see? He wasn't just rejected because he broke the rules. He did. But he was rejected because he had a greater fear of what they would say about him rather than what God would say about him. His transcendence, Saul's, is transcended. He sees how much of a screw-up he's become, and he hates it, and he lies about it, and he covers it up, and he runs away, and he says, no, not me. And then Samuel pushes him, and he says, but it's their fault. And here's the coolest part. You know what he does next? He says, I was bringing him back to sacrifice to God. He gets religious. Isn't that convenient? He gets religious all of a sudden when he's exposed. He says, no, I was bringing it to church. That's what I was doing. You missed the whole point. He's ducking, he's running, he's covering, and here's the proof. The proof is this. At the end of the story, you read that Saul says, I'm sorry, I've sinned. But he's still rejected. Later on, much later, we'll get to David. And David makes a really, really dumb decision in his life. And David really, really screws up. And then David gets confronted with it by Nathan. And David gets exposed. And David says, I'm sorry, I've sinned. And God forgives him. What's going on? Commentators point out that Saul most likely is not truly apologizing. He's lied and lied and shifted blame and run and covered. And then he says, I was just doing it for the church. And at the end of it, when he's totally exposed and flat out, he says, now I'm sorry. What commentators point out is that he's not really sorry for what he did. He's sorry for being caught. And you know this if you have little children and you catch them doing something they shouldn't be doing. And they'll look at you and they say, well, I'm sorry. And you know sometimes that they're not really sorry for what they've done because they don't even know what they've done. They're just sorry that they got caught. Saul, he's not truly repentant. He's just sorry that he got caught. But you and I can take a lesson away from this evening. Saul gets exposed. And like you and like me, it's his greatest fear come true. Now everybody knows how much of a failure he is. Now everybody knows what a phony he is. And he's killed by it. He's racked with guilt. And ultimately God says, get out. You feared them more than you feared me. Now, how do you get it back? Here's the ending. Samuel tells him. Remember I said that before that Saul was a humble king when he first started. And Saul came from the tribe of Benjamin, which was the lesser of the tribes. And Samuel reminds him of this. He says, though you were small in your eyes, Saul, God made you big. But Saul went off and built himself a monument to make himself big. Samuel says, you were puny. You were tiny. You were hiding in that luggage over there. You didn't deserve to be king. But God made you big, he says. Brothers and sisters, do you want the answer to how to stop living in fear of people looking in the keyhole at your life? To how to stop living in fear of what people are going to find out about you if they could see through the keyhole on everything you've ever done and said and thought and all the condition of your heart? You want to not be guided by fear? Samuel says, here's the answer. You were small. He made you big. But all your life, you've been trying to make yourself big and important and respectable. And Saul even goes to such great lengths that he builds a monument to himself. And Samuel says, you've missed the entire point of grace. Samuel is giving you the gospel. Do you see this now? Come back to me. If you don't doubt, because this is the Old Testament, you don't know if Jesus is here, this is the gospel. It's grace. Samuel says, you were small. You didn't deserve to be king. Nothing in you merited being a king. You were from the tribe of Benjamin. You were a scrawny yet handsome little boy. You were shaking in your boots, and you went and hid when we wanted to make you king. You don't deserve it, Samuel says. But he did it for you. It's a way to say this. If you and I can stop trying to make ourselves big, we'll realize that by grace, it's God who became small so that we might be big. It is through Jesus coming as a poor, person hung onto a cross. Do you see this? The Godhead, he became small so that you get big. So then why do you and I go around like Saul, puffing our chest out and trying to make ourselves big, building monuments to ourselves, lying and covering and ducking and running and saying, I'm not, no, that's not me. Blame them. We will always live lives of fear of the other. Unless the gospel helps realign us to put our fear in the right place, to be in awe of the one who was king, lost it all, so that you get it all. Charlotte Elliott was a writer of a hymn. And as I close, here's what she said. She was in poor physical condition, and her brother was a minister doing a fundraiser, and she couldn't help him. And she started reflecting on the fact that all of her life she had been able to help her family. She'd been able to be there for them. She was always kind of the fixer. She was always the maker, the doer, the fixer. She was always there. But because of her poor physical condition now, she couldn't help in this small, meaningless way, in just a small way, to help her brother raise this money that they were raising for a good cause. And she felt crushed. She felt defeated. She felt helpless and useless. And from that, she writes this great hymn, "Just as I am, without one plea, but that thy blood was shed for me, and now thou bidst me come to thee." In her, it took her physical humility to realize, I go to God just as I am, without one plea. Listen tonight, you have a choice. You can go to God like Saul and say, not me, I'm not that bad. I didn't really do it, it's their fault. I'm doing it for the church. You can come up with every excuse, every rationale to cover yourself, to hide the shame, to block the keyhole. You'll always be living in fear. You'll always be hungry for the affirmation of other people, needing them because you're afraid, unless you can say, I see Jesus become small, even to death on a cross. I need not hide anything more, just as I am, without one plea, but that thy blood was shed for me, little old me. Samuel says, Saul, you didn't deserve it. By grace, you've gotten it. And you go off and build monuments to yourself. And not much has changed in a couple thousand years, has it not, brothers and sisters? We will live our lives building monuments to ourselves, saying, I'm not that bad, until you see the one, Jesus the King. He wasn't hiding in the luggage. He was bare on the cross. He says, I know you. And in Psalm 139, David says, O Lord, you've searched me. You know me. This is the only person in your life who knows you and loves you in spite of all he knows, because his son went to die for you. The gospel is just that. It's the good news that everybody else will look through the keyhole at your life and they'll judge you, or they'll run away from you. Or they'll say, get out of here. Or they'll say, what's wrong with you? God's the only one who looks through the keyhole at your life. He says, come. Not with any pleas, not with your record. Just as you are, without one plea, but that my son didst die for thee. Died for you. Now, who are you going to fear? Go in prayer. Take time now, reflect on this. What does it mean to escape the fear of man, to live in the fear of a God who accepts you just as you are, without one plea?